The stewardship then, you go from being an organizer basically on your own. The union comes in. Then after the war, you come back to Santa Monica in about 47 in the B classification.
Right.
And then decide to run for shop steward.
Right.
Now, and you're, and that was steward of a department of
a department.
Agency, you
say. Yes. Uh huh.
Can you, do you recall much about the election itself? Was there someone else running?
No.
Mm-hmm.
No, I was unopposed. They were having a hard time getting anyone to represent them.
Mm-hmm.
That would take the time and, you know, and be willing to do that. They really did.
And what was your relationship to the five women you said, were these friends of yours, or did you spend time with them, or was there any difference between them and, say, any relationship between you and them and the male workers in your unit?
Well, I mean, they were friends of mine. You know, I remember there was one woman there who was not really very mechanically inclined, and she was an older woman. But she came back, you know, on a job offer, too, and I remember I got along fine with them. I really did. I got along fine with the gals and the men, too. No problem at all. All about the same, really.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember this one woman. You know, it came time after I was an A. I got my A. When it came time for her seniority for the A, you know, the company was going to disqualify her. And I knew she wasn't a good mechanic. I worked right with her, and I knew. I thought, oh, boy, this is going to really be tough. This is going to be tough. This is going to be really tough. And mind you now, I'm just a shop steward. So I tried to convince the company that she was qualified, you know. I said, well, try her on another job. And they said, well, we're not going to create a job for her. You know, the job that we have here that we need an A on, and there were very few jobs then, you see. You know, I mean, there were just so few jobs that you could really, job description-wise, you could say that's an A job, that's a B job, period.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, boy, I'm telling you, so you really had to be qualified, you know, to be able to get that job. So anyway, I told myself that they just gave her a little time and, you know, on the job that she would be able to pick it up and she'd be just fine. And I reminded them how during the war they never questioned that sort of thing. They were glad to have anybody come in and work, you know, and she was one of them. And she, you know, all these arguments that I thought would win my case without filing a grievance. Well, it just didn't work. So I thought, well, I still don't think it's fair because after all, you know, give her all and I think the company should we should be entitled to a little more consideration, maybe even beyond what the contract says, because of what we did during the war. Well, doggone it. So I filed a grievance for her. It was denied. And do you know, it went all the way to arbitration.
Hmm.
And do you know, that's the first time that I had anything ever to do with arbitration. And I was, mind you, I was still a shop steward. I was not even a bargaining committee. But I felt so strongly about this thing that it was unfair. That I asked to be a co-arbitrator or whatever to work with the arbitrator on the thing, and co-counsel.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I was, co-counsel. And they agreed to let me do it, you know. And you know, we won the case. We won that case, and that woman is she never did take a lead job, but she got her A classification, and she stayed there till she retired.
Mm.
And she attends all of our retiree chapter meetings out here now. And she actually was the first vice president of the retiree chapter, but it doesn't show it on the record. On our roots, our history,
yeah.
It doesn't show that she was the first vice president. And we had a woman that was the first president of retirees, Bambi Forth. But our records don't reflect that either. They don't want to reflect that.
Mm.
But anyway, this past year, Bernice Storm was her name, the gal that I signed the grievance for. And Bernice Storm, just this last year, she visited China, and she went to visit our ambassador, Leonard Woodcock, who was the president of Reagan, you know, for a long time. But anyway, that was my first experience. And now that is one case. You see, you're asking me, I'm trying to dig back
to
memory. And one of the reasons I felt so strongly about it is I realized she wasn't extremely mechanically inclined, but I felt she should be given a little consideration.
Mm-hmm.
For everything that she had contributed during the war.
Mm-hmm.
No. So, anyway, that was a tough one, and of course, I was very proud of that.
Yeah.
And being that we only had so few people in that department, everybody knew that she wasn't that good, mm-hmm. you know. And so I gained a little respect to show them that I did have the ability mm-hmm. to fight their cases. And that helped a lot.
Oh.
It really helped a lot.
Did they, did most people feel you were doing the right thing, or did they object to your, because they felt she wasn't that skilled, did they object to your...
Well, the men resented it.
Mm-hmm.
The men felt that, you know, that if she couldn't do the job, she shouldn't have it.
Mm-hmm.
Period.
Now, did you have problems as a result deciding to go into arbitration on it?
No.
Mm-hmm.
No. I found out that when I came out that that actually they respected me for
mm-hmm.
it. In other words, I honestly think it was for a selfish reason because you know, they felt that if I could handle that, I could
yeah,
handle other
right.
other things. Really, that's
they
the only reason. Well, that's it.
Yeah.
See, really and truly, really and truly.
Do you recall the nature of other grievances as shop stewards?
Well, you know, I'll tell you, the company, we used to have a no-smoking rule. And a lot of our men, especially a lot of our vets, were returning heavy smokers, you know. And so what they would do, they would sneak off in the restroom. And you weren't even allowed to smoke in the restroom. And what they were trying to do, of course, is keep the people on the job. They tried to make us think that it was because they didn't want to catch fire and all that kind of stuff in the building and all that sort of thing. But they just wanted the people on the job. And so, anyway, a lot of our grievances were, we had plant security.
Mm-hmm.
And these plant security people would be going around constantly in and out of the restrooms. And if they'd catch somebody in the restroom or out in the aisle, they'd write them up. And my God, most of our grievances were like, no, we're stupid. We had to prove that they were not smoking. And it was ridiculous. And, you know, I think back in those days, if you had, I think it was 3 reprimands. They would, you'd be issued a reprimand. And I think it was 3 that you were then possibly put yourself in a position of being fired. You could be fired if you had a 4th one,
mm-hmm.
clear out. And so that's why we were concerned about them building up, you know. Just because there was no smoking, that didn't matter. I mean, just 3 or 4, you were out.
Yeah.
So we were constantly spending our time on those stupid grievances. An awful lot of those, and I used to think it's ridiculous. And I used to keep saying, by gosh, now, in our next contract, let's get this no-smoking thing knocked out, and let's be able to take care of business that's business instead
mm-hmm.
of a stupid no-smoking thing. And so eventually we did. Eventually we did. I remember I had one gal. That was she was going to be cleared out. They were going to fire her, and it was her last one, you know. And I was on the bargaining committee then, and I arbitrated that case, and I won that case too. I had to actually take the arbitrators and the consuls clear out to the building 12 is where it happened, and take them to the restroom to prove to them that plant protection female couldn't have possibly seen in that particular stool where that girl was, whether she was smoking or not. Impossible, you know. And so I won that arbitration case, but. As far as types of grievances, oh my, the clear-outs were the most difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And the clear-outs were the most difficult, you know, to win.
Mm-hmm.
And the clear-outs were usually, like for absenteeism or insubordination, you know,
mm-hmm.
or possibly that disqualified in a job,
mm-hmm.
you know. Mm-hmm. But after we got the no-smoking clause knocked out, Then the predominant number of cases in our docket would be bypassing. In other words, like this gal, the company says we won't promote her to an A because she can't do the job. So they'd bypass them.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe they want to bypass a woman or even men
mm-hmm.
to get to this person down here.
Mm-hmm.
See? And so the predominant number of grievances were on a bypass basis.
Mm-hmm.
More of those than disqualification or...
And that,
clear out or anything.
As steward, you would handle that rather than the seniority committee.
Well, the seniority committee, the seniority committee's function would be to scrutinize the files to be sure that it's like a watchdog
mm-hmm.
of all of the operations, you know, and meet with the company, you know, once a week, and then publish reports to the stewards so that they could use it.
Yeah.
And you know, and then they could call us at any time to ask about what's this person's seniority date and. And I've got a person here with what's that person's senior date, so I'll know if I've got something happening out in the shop that you don't know about up there.
Yeah.
You see, that sort of thing.
So,
see?
On the princess on a bypass, would you go to the seniority committee with it, or would this be handled as a grievance first?
Many cases, we would find that the company's going to arbitrarily bypass, and we'd notify the steward, and that steward would go to that employee then
mm-hmm.
and say, you're being bypassed for such and such a job. And then that person would say, well, I want that job. So that's going to initiate a grievance out there. The shop steward would file a grievance. Now, there were cases where we'd have mass, violations. And if that would happen, then that would be the function of the bargaining committee to immediately call a meeting with the company and say, hey, we've got 12 people in S&S and you're moving over to hydraulics or something like that, and we want to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
Then if the company didn't want to do anything about it, then it would go to the presidential level where they have a presidential investigation,
mm-hmm.
where you bring in one international representative of the president and you talk to the company about it on a higher level mm-hmm. to try to get the thing mm-hmm. straightened out. But the grievances had to be filed, initiated in the shop.
Did you have a certain amount of, as steward, basically release time for your stewardship work that was covered in your contract, for instance, X amount of hours a week that you could spend,
Just reasonable. That's all.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't any specific time call out there. If the provision of the contract that if a steward's needed, your employee calls for a steward, and the company's obligated to give that steward a pass. And when they issue you a pass, then you sign in on a job charge, so it takes your time off the job you're on and put it on a union charge. It doesn't cost the union, but it's their bookkeeping. That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go out on that job and you stay out as long as necessary to investigate it, mm-hmm. And possibly, hopefully solve it before it ever gets to the grievance stage. That mm-hmm. was what I used to like to do, And I had very few grievances in my area. Once I found out how to use the union and how to find out the information I needed, and learn how, through rumors and things something might happen, boy, I'd go to management and I'd try to correct mm-hmm. it and keep it from happening.
Mm-hmm.
That was the most desirable way to operate a department.
And as a steward, primarily you would work with the party that had the grievance and the foreman.
And the immediate assistant foreman.
Yeah.
That's right. And then I became a chief steward. What I would, as a chief steward, when a steward needed some help on a grievance or a steward needed to confer with somebody on something, that was your next level up, and you'd call your chief steward. Then I would go out, and assist the stewards on their problems. And in many cases, I would assist even in helping them prepare their briefs as far as the grievances are concerned. And in many cases assist, be called in as a witness or whatever in processing the grievance in second step hearing, they call it,
mm-hmm.
And then maybe even pre-arb, whatever. See, but then when I became when the bargaining committee, on that level, then the chief steward, if they needed help, they would call the bargaining committee
mm-hmm.
then, and then I would go out with them on that. And I would also, then as a bargaining committee man, we only had one committee at that time. Then it went into two later. It went into a negotiating committee and a grievance committee.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was in there, we did both.
Those
we did you bet negotiating and grievance hearing. And all shifts. You handle the whole damn thing, So what we would do, our function would be to go out and investigate things if they needed us, and then to be in the to sit in the hearings two or three times a week. Once the grievances were filed, then we'd be there to process them. See?
Now, again, was that you would do the same thing in terms of accountability of time? You would just check off.
Bargaining committee,
time.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Sign out. Now. I've never had, I didn't have any problems with management, and we didn't have, only when it was close to the termination of our contract time, the company would try to put pressure and tie down the steward's activity out the shop, keep him from running around. So they would say, well, now wait a minute, why were you going 2 hours or 3 hours? Take that long just to check that out over there, And, some of our stewards, the new ones, would get very panicky and sometimes get in terrible beefs over it,
mm.
whereas the old pros knew how to handle it. And it's still going on that way out in the plant. Whenever we get towards the end of our contract, why, the company tries to tie the stewards out so they can't get the information out to the people, see?
Yeah.
And we have had stewards get in a lot of trouble. when I first became active, we didn't even have to have a pass. All you had to do is, once you got a call from through the proper channels, you would sign in, on your union time, and then you'd go. But we had some people became active that really wanted to milk it,
mm-hmm.
and they wanted to be full-time, and they would go out and they'd take a person off a job and go outside the building, and they'd spend 5, 6, 7, 8 hours, whatever, and unnecessarily so. So it made it tough on the other people who were trying to do a proper
mm-hmm.
job. And so the company finally, during one of the negotiations, they finally got the union to agree to the pass system.
Uh-huh.
And so when I was active, I would just leave and I would go to the supervisor and whatever I had, wherever I had to go, and say, I'm going to talk to so-and-so and take them off the job. But now you have to have a pass, and when you leave that area and you go to another area, the supervisor in the area has to sign it, the time, and they really, really, really try to tie it up, you know. And that's too bad.
Mm.
But it's the stewards themselves that caused that.
Now, as when you were a steward, before you became chief steward, at that point, was there a training, steward's training, or not? Or did that come like after you were chief steward?
I don't recall just when it did come, but it came in right in that period there, where they started having educational classes, which, mm-hmm. you know, were real great.
And what about meetings among...
We had our stewards council meeting now.
Oh,
we always had those once a month.
Uh-huh.
Oh, yes. Well, once a month, and according to our bylaws, in order for you to... You had to attend 2 out of 3,
mm-hmm.
you know, and if you didn't attend 2 out of 3 meetings, then they would decertify you.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one of the reasons I might point out that some of these people would take a shop steward's job is because you would have super seniority. And if you were a shop steward and it was a layoff in your department, you'd be the last one to be laid off no matter what your seniority was.
Oh.
So a lot of them would take it only for the super seniority, but they didn't particularly care about servicing your people. And, you know, it was a real hairy thing. I didn't like it at all. And if we knew of an election coming up in an area and we thought somebody was going in there for that reason, we would go in there and politic and try to get somebody else to run that had seniority, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, we'd have the steward council meetings once a month, and we would have a chairman of that council would be somebody elected from the stewards themselves. And at that time, we would discuss our problems in the shop. But we'd have a steward get up and say, I've got this problem, and I don't quite know how to handle it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so there'd be people there from the bargaining committee and seniority committee, and we would try to tell them how to handle it, you know, and discuss it. And it was a very, very good situation, very, very healthy.
So it helped a great deal.
Yeah, but, yeah, it was training.
When you were steward, before you became chief steward, were those going on
yes.
then?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, they were.
Do you recall at that point other women being stewards? Like at those meetings, would there be other women who were shop stewards too?
There was a gal on the seniority committee. But as far as the steward's concerned, I don't remember.
Mm-hmm.
But there was Lodi Mae Bickerstaff was on the executive board then, and trying to think of her name. Was on the seniority committee, and those are the gals that I became really acquainted with. You know, as far as shop steward's concerned, I don't recall any women. No.
It sounds like you were a shop steward for about a year and then ran for chief steward.
Year or maybe two,
yeah.
I'm not sure. Uh-huh, but it was very close by.
And you changed to A classification. What work were you actually doing during that period?
I'm trying to remember whether I actually changed the job or I stayed right on a job and just got the classification. I don't remember. Things were pretty tight then, and I would be willing to bet, if I had to go back and dig out the record and everything else, that I moved to another job in that department. Because when the plant built up, there were a lot of people that actually, maybe where we're doing B work, but they put under seniority, they got the B pay. But that took a long, long time before we got to that point.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
No. But then again, we also had some cases that I filed grievances where people were classified as B and doing A work. But you see, once I got job descriptions and I learned how to interpret those job descriptions, and I could really know what they meant, and then break a job down.
Yeah.
Then I would file a grievance and say, hey, that person's classified as B and they're doing A work. And so,
what was the difference between A and B in that time period?
Well, it would be generally the level of complexity.
Mm-hmm.
Generally the level of complexity of a job.
Mm-hmm.
But what you would have would have it in writing. It would describe. It would be a description that the company union have agreed to as to work content. This is A work. This is B work. Okay.
What would be an example? Say, were you still riveting at that point?
Oh, always riveting.
Yeah. So it would be. in more difficult locations, or
not necessarily? That might be one. I mean, it might be one thing as far as accessibility to get the proper quality workmanship out. You know, they have the skill to do it. But many times it would be, for instance, your B and your A. Your A would have a job, perhaps, where they would have to constantly work from a blueprint, constantly have to do some research, or constantly refer to technical manuals, okay, that sort of thing, see? Or perhaps, for instance, the one thing that was very definitely spelled out in your job description, which was if you worked on old tool material, which is very thin material,
mm-hmm.
you had to have a lot of skill to be able to work with that material and have it come out a quality product, see? That was another thing
mm-hmm.
that determined the A and B.
Now, at one point, had you mentioned that you were given an opportunity to develop more skills based on seniority? Did they go back to more and more complex jobs after the war? Because before the war, to quickly bring in a lot of people, they broke the jobs down into smaller components and more specialized. Did they go into less more skilled jobs afterwards for which you had to get some additional training or not?
Well, now after the war, as I was telling you, in Douglas and Long Beach, and the manufacturing part of it, it was mostly all small parts
mm-hmm.
or a part, fillets or a tail cone for a ship
mm-hmm.
or something like that, but not a complete aircraft,
mm-hmm.
okay? So there wasn't...
So it was
sub-assemblies. It was, yeah, mostly mm-hmm. subs, that's right. Uh-huh. Sub-assemblies is what it was called.
Mm-hmm.
And then, and that was mostly, that was all surface and structure skills.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't have, we didn't have even any electrical or hydraulic thing like that until many years later, you know, until the Korean War, we started building up
mm-hmm.
where we actually started putting out planes and refurbishing. Ships would come in, some old A-20s come in on the line, and we would strip them and refurbish them. Put hydraulic lines, electrical equipment, put new hatches on. Well, then you had to have different classifications,
mm-hmm.
see, because of the different skills.
And would people with seniority be able to get those skills, or would they hire in people with the skill?
Okay, well, the way we had that, we had a provision in our contract whereby you could put a request in. They call it, what we'd call it now is bidding, like
mm-hmm.
they do in the auto industry, you bid for a job. But you could put a request in for that classification, to get into that classification. Well, it had to be a promotion for you anyway, first before they release you. And when you put in your request for that classification, you had to give like a little resume or whatever to show you how you're qualified,
mm-hmm.
you know, qualifications. Well, everything depended upon the job market. If the company had plenty of people out there to hire, they're already trained, fine. You know, they've just hired and you wouldn't ever have a chance to get anything else
mm-hmm.
like that. But when the job market was tight, then they would you know, release so many from this area, so many from this area, and they would take them in and train them.
Mm-hmm.
And they would have them certified.
Mm-hmm.
People that would, like, took people from the stock room, and they made electricians out of them. Well, to become an electrician, you have to be certified for your soldering and your all that kind of stripping
mm-hmm.
and lugging and all that, you know. Same thing with hydraulics.
Yeah.
And same thing with welding.
Now, did you stay in riveting the entire time?
Well, it wasn't called riveting, but that's it's called assembly.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But your
mm-hmm.
job was?
Assembly.
Was,
mm-hmm. It required riveting.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
But increasing complexity in terms of reading blueprints.
Right.
Did you end up ever doing tooling yourself at all, or someone would still come in and do?
No, we never did any tooling.
Uh-huh.
We had people who were classified to do the repair, the maintenance, like
mm-hmm.
Uji Lampi, this mm-hmm. old engineer.
Mm-hmm.
And we were very careful. And I was always, especially, trying to be extremely careful not to infringe upon anybody else's classification,
mm-hmm.
because, you know, here I was a representative of the people, and I certainly wasn't going to violate
yeah.
the contract.
And what was your next classification then after the A?
Lead.
Now, and under the union, there were still lead people.
Under the union, you still had, like within my classification, in assembly. Yes, in assembly, the senior person, if they make a lead, the senior person is considered for that job.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we always said not considered. You're entitled to that job. You're there, the next person, that's your job,
mm-hmm.
you know. And anyway, so it came down to my seniority, and they asked me, you know, if I was interested in it. And a person, you can turn it. You didn't have to take it. You could turn it down. I said, You bet. Sure will. And I was one of the first ones. I guess I was the first one out there. First female lead.
And that, then as lead, what was your job?
All right. Then it was my responsibility to assign the work to the people and to instruct them if they need instructions, you know, and to keep records of their attendance and to order all the parts, you know, and to put the, once the work was complete, to inspect it and put it up and sell it to the company inspector, or if it was commercial, to the customer,
mm-hmm.
you know, also.
Mm-hmm.
And to also, I had to account for all the people's time on a chart. In other words, take credit. It's called a completion chart.
Mm-hmm.
We call 125A. It's like when an employee, you have an estimate given on a job, okay? And so when the job is complete, you're supposed to chart that in.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the week, then they arrive at a performance that you have, offered your job under. And this performance report come out every week, and that was part of the lead man's job,
mm-hmm.
is to report completions. And really and truly, all the lead man was supposed to do is just report completions, just chart up there what's complete. And the supervisor is supposed to determine how much of this work is done, do they want to take credit for that week, and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But a lead man was responsible for his crew, his or her crew, and for making job assignments, if any of your tools need repaired, you call your tooling people in to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Any of your paperwork wasn't good, you got with plumbing, got them down to correct it. Any engineering items like that, you get a hold of whatever engineer you needed, and you took care of it, and you corrected or, you know, made changes or whatever. And that
now,
was a lead man's job.
So also doing your own assembly work as well?
Oh,
or
no.
Or was it mainly the supervisory role?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yes, the company is, years you always say, well, you're working, you're supposed to be able to perform the work, and you are.
Yeah.
Supposed to be able to perform it, but that doesn't mean you're supposed to work.
Yeah.
And actually, we found was that the contract, your job description says that a lead man may not have more than 25 people. That's the maximum number of people. They don't say anything about the minimum, but maximum.
Mm.
And so most of the leads out there, especially in those days, boy, they loaded you. They really loaded you with the 25 people, and maybe you have one or two extra. So you couldn't possibly work and take care of your
mm-hmm.
crew,
mm-hmm.
take care of their needs and make your reports and that sort of thing. Couldn't possibly work.
Now, when was it that you became the lead, when you were the chief steward?
I was in the bargaining committee.
So you'd already moved up from chief steward. Now, let me ask in terms of the chief steward job, did you run against anybody for that?
I sure did.
Can you describe that election?
I don't remember exactly. It couldn't have been anything very dramatic or I would have remembered. I just know that I won,
mm-hmm.
you know. And I was so determined to keep climbing my way up that ladder so that I'd be in a position to know exactly what was going on, you know. And I know that when I was on the bargaining committee, there was quite a bit of concern about when it got down to my seniority for lead, because they said, how are you going to do your job? How can you be a lead man and sit up there in grievance hearings and process your grievances, you know, sort of thing? And I said, I can do it. You know, they said, well, we don't think you can, you know. So what the company wanted to do, they wanted me to give up my union activity and just be there as a lead. I think
mm-hmm.
that's really why they more or less didn't give me any fight when it came down to my seniority as to offering me the job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even though I felt sure that they would rather have had a man, because, you know, they had never had a woman, you know, and they were also, I guess, wondering whether, you know, anyhow, they'd like to, I was becoming very active,
mm-hmm.
and they
mm-hmm.
would just like to see me shut up and go away. But anyway, the crew I had, they were terrific. By that time, you see, I had proved to the people that I could be a good representative. And so I talked it over with my crew, and I told them, I said, you know, I just have to make a decision. I don't know. If I turn it down, you know, let them bypass me, then it's going to be bad. It'll be bad for anybody else. It's going to say, look, here you've got somebody in the bargaining committee
mm-hmm.
that permits themselves to be bypassed, so we can do it to anybody. So that crew of mine, they were fantastic. A lot of people nowadays, when they hear about this, they come up to me and say, but is it true that your crew